the Transverse Network, this is The Transgender Show, an interview program about self-acceptance and discovery. I'm your host, Emily. This week on the show is Jasmine Vine, a content creator from Adelaide, Australia, who helps trans folks recover from trauma. Her story is one of great hardship, bullying, domestic violence, serious mental illness, and both parents dying by 21, yet she's overcome it all. Suicidal from age 7, being diagnosed with all sorts of things, including bipolar type 1, landing her in the psych ward at 17, she now owns her own company, Javine, where she helps transgender people feminize their voices and helps people recover from trauma and develop an empowered mindset so they can feel more hopeful, confident, comfortable, and safe. Help me welcome the woman who went from suicidal in the psych ward to now a powerhouse inspiration to her thousands of followers and host of the Trans Boss podcast, Jasmine Vine.
Hello, thank you for having me on.
It's wonderful to have you here. And I apologize for smiling at that last sentence, but it is one that Jasmine wrote, and it's a very heavy sentence to go through. The woman who went from suicidal in the psych ward to now a powerhouse inspiration to her thousands of followers. What a story, what a turnaround. Let's actually just jump right into the serious stuff and get there. I was very happy to hear in the pre-show that the trauma that you experienced in your early days, because I know you transitioned very early, wasn't directly related to your gender transition, not at home at least. Can you speak a little bit about what it was that you were dealing with there and how your family received the fact that you were transgender?
Yeah, so as a kid, I never really got any disapproval from my parents or family members about how feminine I was. It wasn't really a discussion. So I would consistently, you know, watching Sailor Moon and pretending that I'm, you know, got beautiful nails and long hair, and I'd, you know, use a scarf as, you know, pretend hair or as a skirt and stuff. And my parents didn't blink an eye at it. They were like, that's a kid having fun. And so it was never made wrong. And I think part of that was my family had grown up around my uncle, who was quite effeminate gay man who did drag and of that kind of stuff. And so they'd come to terms with that and kind of just assigned me as the same thing, which I wasn't, but it allowed them to be more accepting of me. So that was good. It was more so at school where the issue was, that lack of acceptance.
On that bit of your story, the fact that you had this effeminate gay uncle, was there a lot of thought that had influenced you and influenced your identity among your, you know, your family members? Was that something that was brought up?
I'm not sure entirely. When I came out as trans initially, my mum thought that I was coming out as a feminine gay person, which I mean, she's right, but not in the way she thought. So it did kind of paint the picture of how they viewed me, but I don't think it really changed how I viewed myself at all. I always felt quite distinct from my uncle and what he was doing, but there definitely was one time where he put me in like drag makeup because I was really interested in watching Drag Race at the time, and I was like, oh, I really like, you know, the makeup and stuff. And he was like, I can do that if you if you want to. And that was like really good for me at that time because I so much gender euphoria. It's just absolutely brilliant. So part of that helped me to come to terms with myself more, I think. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
That's nice. It's nice to have that ally in your family, even though, you didn't experience a lot of rejection within your family. So I think that's really beautiful. Yeah. I think we'll jump tracks just slightly. I don't want to jump right into the bullying. I kind of want to lighten it up for the beginning here. So let's jump over to my favorite question to start with. How did you choose your name?
Oh, I've changed my name a whole bunch of times since beginning. I initially changed my name to something that I thought was easier for people to get a hold of. So my name was Izzy at the time because that was closer to my dead name. And that was nice for a little while. There's still some people that call me that, like you do from back in the day. But I went through a few iterations there. I knew that that wasn't where I wanted to land. And I started playing around with some things like Zakaria, which again was closer to my dead name, and playing around with things like that. But none of that really felt right to me. And so what I ended up doing is I've actually got it in my drawer here. I got a notepad and I wrote down a bunch of names that I liked based on different things. I was watching Orange is the New Black at some point and I was like, Alex is really nice. I thought that, Alexandra or something along those lines. And I basically just wrote all of the names down that I liked. And then I gave it to my mum and her partner at the time. And they sat down and went through all of the names and wrote commentary, which probably won't be able to see very well, but they wrote commentary on all of these names. It's like Alexandria, Alexandra. I don't know if I can swear on this. But they
Oh
put the
yeah.
B word. Okay.
Yeah, it's fine.
So
Whatever
they put
language you need to express what's going on for you is fine. And if it's somebody else's
excellent.
words of expression, then that's even better.
Beautiful. Because yeah, they basically just commentated. They said, this one, nah, sounds like a bitch. This one sounds like a tart. I'm like, what? This one doesn't sound like a name. I was trying to play around with some interesting sounding names. And one that I chose was Angela backwards, because I thought Allegna sounded cool. But so yeah, I played with a whole bunch of them. And the one that was starred was actually Jasmine, as well as a couple of others like Xanthia, Kira, all of those I really liked, Jade, Opal. But yeah, I ended up going with Jasmine partly because I wanted a name that was clearly feminine, that wasn't, one or the other. And I think at that time for me it was insecurity choosing to do that, but it's ended up working quite nicely. I quite like the name now. It really fits me. And yeah, it's really stuck.
Well, I really like when people are able to involve their parents in some way in the name choice and give them a little bit of power for it. It brings them into the process and can ease some of the transition pains there for them. So I do like that. I did want to say Allegna, I don't like the GN sound so much, but I think if you did a French pronunciation on it, Alenia could have been pretty darn
Oh,
good.
Alenia, don't mind that.
Who knows? Maybe this time next year, Jasmine will be gone and
Not again. Oh
not again.
gosh.
Yeah, you're too established
Too
now.
many rebrands.
Yeah. At this point, yeah, renaming is much easier to do than rebranding. That's a tough one. So yeah, you're locked in. You're locked in.
In saying that, though, the name, because my last name is Vine, Jasmine Vine is also a plant. And so now, whenever anyone tries to search me online, they get plants. Was an unintended consequence of choosing this name.
Completely
There you
can
go.
confirm. I did experience that today.
Oh, gosh. There you go.
So, when you transitioned very early, when did you start that whole process? Let's see. Well, usually what I like to do is start at the end and work back. And I think probably in your story, that's going to be a good way to go as well. So, when did you realize that you were transgender, that that was the term that fit you and that you needed to start, presenting differently and making some changes?
So what's interesting for me is I didn't come to the understanding that I was trans before social transition, which is kind of strange. But it was a situation of looking at how do I prefer to present? What do I prefer to put out there? Do I prefer to have long hair or short hair? I knew I'd prefer to have long hair. Do I prefer these kind of clothes or those kinds of clothes? And it was an exploration process for me over time. And initially, I came out as a gay male, and I was very effeminate, like from that point on. I would wear a full face of makeup, I would wear, feminine clothes. And over time, because I was growing my hair out and because I was getting better at makeup and I was, wearing more and more feminine clothes, I started getting to the point where from behind, someone would come to me and be like, "Hey, miss." And it was really affirming to hear that. And that was like some of the first times where I was like, "Oh, I'm starting to be mistaken for a woman. I'm starting to get she, her pronouns used for me." And it felt really nice. I was like, "I'm okay with that." And it kind of just cascaded from there to the point that I had practically socially transitioned before coming to terms with the fact that I was trans. Yeah, kind of strange. We were talking before about the acceptance from family, and I actually think that that has played a part in that whole process of transition for me because I had a broader perspective on what is feminine, what is masculine, and it was a little bit more mishmashed for me than I guess other people at school would say. So part of that whole process was like, "Oh, guys can have long hair. That's no problem. Guys can wear makeup. Sure, guys can wear more feminine clothes. Guys can do this, guys can do that." And it cascaded to the point that I was like, "Huh, well, maybe I'm just not a guy if I want all of those things." Which is, yeah. That acceptance, and that broader perspective, I think really played a part in that for me. Whereas if I was scolded and like, "No, boys don't do that," I think it may have played out a bit differently. There might have been more shame around it.
So how old were you when you went through this process?
Social transition around about 14 is when I really started getting into that. And it started out as I was presenting more femme on like the weekends and for places like outside of school at the time. I had a wig that I would wear and more feminine clothes. So I was kind of living as myself part-time, and I found that I just wanted to live as that version of me more and more and more and more. And so then I started wearing the wig to school, and then I started, wearing more feminine sort of stuff to school. So yeah, it was definitely from 14 by 15 and a half, 16, I was living as myself full time.
And when did you start experiencing the bullying, or at least the kind of the more severe bullying?
One of my earliest memories is being in kindergarten, and we were all painting on these little easels, and all of the boys in the class were painting cars and, things like that. And I painted a little pot with a pink flower, and someone called me a faggot from that. I was like, whoa, I didn't even know what it meant. And it kind of didn't slow down from that point.
So right from the start, yeah. you were different than other than boys, and you were called out for it.
Pretty much. I was always a lot more feminine than any of the boys around me. And it wasn't until, like, when I came out as a gay guy and I started being more effeminate in my expression, that was probably the most reprieve I had. Because prior to that, it was like, no, I'm not. And I was, you know, denying it all. And after I came out that first step, it didn't affect me as much because I was like, yeah, of course I am. Absolutely. I'm very feminine, of course.
Took a lot of the bite out of their slurs, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. So that was a big help. And then it started again with when I started identifying as a woman, and then the bullying was more around like, oh, you'll never be a woman, you know, blah, 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 blah. You'll always be a man, all that kind of stuff. So then some of the bite came back in because it was another sore spot.
Mm-hmm. And was that, were people doing that to your face? Was that happening in school?
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
Amazing that people would be brave enough to actually do it in person. You know, usually it's online with the comments, people hiding behind their keyboards.
Lots of online stuff, because I was active on YouTube at the time as well. And in school, though, there were a few instances where, so there was an instance where somebody started throwing pieces of wood at me, like chunky pieces of wood. And that happened a couple of times. You know, there was one time on a playground where there was like a group of people throwing stones and like bark and wood at me. And there was another time that happened in school. And I was brought to the principal's office at that time and like explained the situation, what happened. And I was like, well, it was because they don't see me as who I am. And, all this. And the principal at the time actually, because she asked, you know, is there anything we can do to support you to make this better? I'm pretty sure that kid got expelled from the school. So there was some level of support there. However, when I said what would help me, which was, hey, can I wear the women's school uniform? Because I felt that would help me blend in more. She said no, and said that's going to make me stick out like a sore thumb, apparently. And I ended up just completely disregarding the school code, and I started wearing jeans instead, which still stood out because everyone was in uniform. But wearing the male school uniform is actually what made me stand out. That was a bit of a shitty experience. She later denied that she ever said that. Like, yeah, it was a weird situation. But that bullying was pretty prominent all throughout until I dropped out at like 17. Oh, well, 16, just, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So was that the end of your school experience, or did you end up going back at some point?
No, that was the end of it. I decided that my mental health was much more important than any conventional education. And I don't regret that at all. That was what I needed to do at the time, what I felt was right for my mental health at the time. Because I was dealing with a lot there. And the suicidality was really prominent throughout that time as well. And it was really exacerbated through all of the bullying. And so, yeah, I was like, it's not worth it. I do not care. Like, that's the end of it, essentially. Mm-hmm.
And then I know that it's about this time where you be- was it because of the suicidality and what you were going through there with the mental health that you ended up being held in a psych ward, as you call it?
Yeah, so that was, so I dropped out at 16, and after that point, I did go down a little bit of a spiral. I was in a relationship that was emotionally, mentally abusive, thankfully not physically. But that was a thing. I was addicted to marijuana, and I really had nothing going for me in life. I just kind of felt like I was recovering from all of the experiences. And I was active on YouTube at the time, which is what really helped me hold on, because I was sharing my experience and what I was going through. I was sharing my HRT journey and month one update, month two update, and all of that. And I could see from the comments that that was helping people, and people were coming to terms with their identity and relating to my experiences and everything. And that was fuel for me during those times to stay around, which I'm very, very thankful to. If anyone's watching this who was around back in those days, who shared that kindness and that compassion, that was so, so pivotal for me. But yeah, essentially it was a bit of a spiral that I went into, and I ended up in like a manic episode, which I was quite well aware of because my mum had quite severe bipolar throughout my childhood. So I had seen how it affected her. I kind of knew the signs and symptoms. And so when I experienced it, it was a shock, but it was like, oh, I know what's going on here. Which was a good thing to be able to latch onto there. But from there, I really needed help. I was absolutely just not doing well, and going to the psych ward was really helpful for me, although there were certainly some experiences in there as well where, like, one of the psychiatrists, oh gosh, what was the wording? My mum was really upset about it, I remember, because in a meeting with her, they essentially called me a delusional boy or like something or other. And he was basically viewing being transgender as the issue. Like, that's why I was in the psych ward. And that was one of the first experiences I had when I was actually in the psych ward, was this psychiatrist saying to me, oh, so you're in here because you're delusional, you're a delusional boy. I'm like, what?
Wow.
Yeah. There were a few things like that in there where it was just not a great experience. However, it was also a pivotal point in time where it was essentially, okay, Jasmine, you've got to cut the crap. Like, I'm waking up every day smoking freaking like a train with marijuana and all of that. I'm never even thought about having a job. I was just going absolutely nowhere with my life, and it was not helping my mental health at all. And it was this breaking point for me where I was like, I've got to change something. I've got to start doing something differently now. And that was, it was a good push for me actually to have that. As traumatic as it was, it was a good push for me.
It's a terrible thing about being trans that sometimes we have to go through some pretty intense trauma to get through to the other side, you know. There's the internal struggle like I went through of denying that I was trans and fighting against it completely. There were the external factors that you run up against, especially when you come up to the people that are the ones that are supposed to be taking care of you, supposed to be your guides and your wards, and sort of gaslighting you, the principal at your school, and then this psychiatrist that just misses the mark entirely. How much did that one psychiatrist set back your healing and your ability to actually make good progress there?
I don't feel like it set me back much at all, to be honest. Like, it was a distressing experience at the time, but it was something I felt like I was able to brush off quite easily. And because I had my mum's support with that as well, and she was, you know, helping me kind of come to terms with that and saying, you know, he doesn't know what he's freaking talking about. Mm-hmm. That's the thing as well. He sexualized me in one of the meetings and said maybe we can prescribe a sex toy or something. It was some ridiculous thing that was just so, so out of whack. But I think it was ridiculous enough for me to go, there's the clown. I put no stock in his opinion. Yeah, I did. I was able to not let that affect me much.
So it sounds like a lot of your recovery process then was sort of on your own shoulders. You took it on yourself you took it on yourself to seek out the psychiatric ward that you went into, correct?
I did.
Okay.
Yes.
And then. Yeah. And then it sounds like you came to your realizations while you were there, once you were able to kind of clear your head. What were your next steps then? How did you start moving towards where you are now?
I've probably got it in a folder somewhere actually, but it was the first time where, like post-transition, I'd actually sat down to set some goals. And it was simple, simple things. It was like, where is my life at the moment? Well, there's this, this, and this going on. How much is that helping me? It's not. It's not helping at all. And so I started to set some routines for myself as the first thing. And it was simple things like going for a walk. And it was staying connected with friends, staying connected in like the TransBoss network, which was really helpful for me at the time. And just starting little by little to build in those routines was really helpful for me to start shifting that mindset. And also just looking after myself, developing a sleep routine, developing like a better eating routine, because I would go days without eating. I would stay up all night and like sleep whenever. And so developing a lot of those things was the foundation for me to start building on top of that. I'm trying to think from that point. There was a lot of changes that had to happen in my life. You know, that relationship come to an end, so I moved out of there. I fell into a traineeship, which they were paid to take me on as a trainee. And it was something I was really skeptical of at the time. Because I didn't think I had any worth. I didn't think I was good enough to do anything. I thought I was just this loser who was destined to be unhappy and not achieve anything with my life. That was my mindset at that time. And little by little, I started showing myself evidence that that wasn't true. And really simple things, like celebrating them. When I went into that traineeship, like I said, I was very skeptical. But it was the first time I was around people that had jobs and who were at that time I viewed to be as relatively normal people. And it started to show me a different way of relating to myself and relating to other people and viewing my worth as well, seeing that I could contribute to society in a meaningful way was all of these little things like really started building up my confidence in myself. And it just compounded. I started getting into reading self-development books or like, you know, self-healing type things. Like The happiness trap here is one that was really helpful for me. And I started learning about the languaging that I was using and how I was viewing myself as a victim and like all of these little things. And it just compounded. It kept going. It kept compounding. And yeah, it's hard to put that into like a summarized version, actually, because there was so much that went into that. 12 years of therapy somewhere along the line there as well.
Therapy does help. Therapy does help a lot.
Yeah. I started seeing therapists after my dad died when I was 11. So from then, pretty well consistently throughout my life, I've been seeing, various therapists. One thing I want to mention as well is I went through about 9 different therapists before I found one that really clicked. And that was a thing that I saw a lot of people around me kind of gave up on therapy because they went and saw one person and that person was transphobic, or the person didn't have a clue about anything diversity related. And so it just put them off. But I found, for myself, that was something I had to have a bit of persistence in and continuously try different therapists until I found one that clicked. So, yeah, it was definitely, it's a big journey. It's a big journey.
Mm-hmm. And I love the message of how simple the start was. You're setting yourself some routines. Oh, yeah. And it wasn't, accomplish all these things or whatever. It was, go for a walk, try and eat a little bit better. Set a good sleep schedule. I think that is, that's really important to remember. And we talked a little bit about something similar, the trap that we get into in looking at social media and seeing other people, what they're achieving, how they look, all of those sort of things in their transition. And we like to judge ourselves against that. And I think there's this tendency to look at people who are successful and go like, oh, they've got all these great things. And if they're setting goals for themselves, there's these big lofty goals. But the important thing to remember is how simple it is to get started, to change that momentum in the right direction. And definitely some advice that I need to remember to take myself, because I do that a lot too. I look too far towards the big picture, and instead of focusing on the little things that will just improve my life on a day-to-day basis and make those things easier. So thank you for that.
Yeah. All good. That's really, really important, is because that was another thing that I just remembered. I would write to-do lists for the day that were super simple, like brush my teeth, eat something, drink some water. And sometimes when you're really, really in the depths of that, struggle, in that mental health struggle, doing that is just the tiny little bit of dopamine hit that you get for ticking something off. And it doesn't need to be big. It doesn't need to be a big lofty goal. It can just be the tiniest little thing that helps you just build towards the life that you're wanting. So yeah, super, super important, that one.
I love it. Let's dive into something that I like to get into, to really kind of figure out what this whole experience means to people. What do you feel that this gender exploration, that this journey that you've been on, has meant to you on an ethereal level? What does transition mean for you?
Wow, on an ethereal level. I honestly view it as a gift a lot of the time. I haven't always. It's been something that I've been like, oh, I wish I was born cis, everything would be so much easier, and this, that, and the other. And I think two things can be true at once. Like, yes, it would have been easier. However, I wouldn't have had the experiences that I have had. And that would actually make me a person who is much less aware, who has a much narrower perspective. And transition for me, building that perspective and seeing how the the nastier parts of the world, the nastier parts of, you know, reality as a trans person sometimes, has actually made me a more compassionate person and a more caring and kind person. Because now I don't have that sort of harsh judgment of other people as much. Like, I still do, I'm a human, but I can show a lot more compassion and kindness to people. And I don't think I would have been able to do that without the experience of transition. And to me, I think that's a really, really beautiful thing.
One thing I like to ask, and I love to cover in this, because, you know, there, again, going back to that example that a lot of people see on social media of this sort of perfect life and everything's great, is to talk about dysphoria and sort of the fact that it's something that we all face throughout our journey and even long into it. What forms of dysphoria do you still kind of struggle with, if you do?
Yeah. Initially on my journey, there was a lot of physical dysphoria. However, I think it was physical dysphoria masquerading as social dysphoria. So, you know, I was really preoccupied with the squareness of my chin and how wide my hairline was and, you know, my brow bone and like bump in my nose, and I would pick apart every freaking part of myself. And it was mostly, the reason I say I think is mostly social is because I didn't have much dysphoria in relation to my body. I didn't like body hair. I wanted that to be less. It's like that was a thing for me. But I didn't necessarily have massive top dysphoria or bottom dysphoria. That wasn't so much a thing for me. It was more so about the roles that I fit into and feeling excluded from like female spaces or, you know, feminine gender spaces, that was really more of the struggle for me. And I thought it was all physical. I thought, oh, if I get all of these surgeries and stuff, then I'll be fine. I'll be happy, yada, yada. But it actually wasn't about that. It was about my lack of acceptance of myself and worrying about other people's opinions of me. That I think was the big part. And so socially, people, you know, using the wrong pronouns for me or dead naming me or like all of that kind of stuff, where they'll look at me funny if I'm going into a, you know, women's restroom, or all of that kind of stuff was where I felt most of my dysphoria. Nowadays, I wouldn't say I experience a lot of dysphoria nowadays. I think it's a lot less. I have a lot of acceptance for myself. I still have things about myself that I'm like, it'd be nice if that wasn't there. But it doesn't bother me. It doesn't make me question myself. It doesn't make me question my validity in any way. It's not a hurtful thing to me at all now. But where there still is a little bit, I think, is social expectations. Because, and this is something that I talk about fairly openly sometimes, is I haven't had any surgeries. I don't plan on having any surgeries. And standing up to go to the bathroom is something that I do every freaking day. That is not something I feel, you know, weird about in any way, because I have a body, my body has the parts that it has, and my gender is the gender that it is. Like, that is just who I am. And so from my perspective, why do I need to fit into gender roles and act as though I have a body that I don't? It doesn't sit with me, and neither do I. It's a horrible joke there, but when I think about socially, particularly people that I care about their opinions, that's where that little bit of self-doubt creeps in, is where I'm like, oh, what will they think of me if that? And it was something literally just like a couple of hours ago, that popped into my mind for whatever reason when I was in the bathroom, was like, would I be okay with this if my partner was like able to see me, or would I feel weird about that? And I think I would feel weird, but is that dysphoria, or is that just because it's weird for someone to watch you pee? I don't know.
I'm not sure where that falls completely. I know it is a little weird to watch your partner pee, and yet the amount of times it happens in this house, I've gotten way over it. That's really beautiful to hear that you don't struggle with much dysphoria, because you know that can be a heck of a stumbling block for us sometimes, and can, you know, set us into those spirals. You transition very early. I don't assume that you have a lot of struggle blending in as a woman and being seen as a woman in society. I really appreciate the fact that you have taken the steps to remain a very public trans woman. You're very public mm-hmm. as a trans person. What has been the main drive for that in staying so public instead of, you know, trying to blend in more often?
I've gone both ways with it. When I was early in transition, I was very public about it. I shared my journey online, like YouTube and all of that. And it was a very big part of my identity and how I related to the world. Once I went into that traineeship, I basically went into it in stealth. So no one in the workplace knew that I was trans, and that went on for a couple of years. And I dropped off the face of the earth, like on social media and everything. I really kept to myself. And I used I'm going to call it an excuse because it was for me. I used the excuse that I'm just like any other woman. And so I should just, you know, exist as myself and, you know, be comfortable in the world and all of that. And yes, I agree, like with that younger version of myself. But it was actually internalized transphobia in disguise. I thought that that was the best thing for me and that I could just exist and be happy and all of that. However, not being open about my trans identity was almost like it was a wall that was in front of me and other people. Because even little things like someone at work would ask me, do I have a tampon? And I would be like, oh, no, sorry, I don't have any. And it was almost like this little level of shame came up in each of those things, because I felt like I wanted to be open and I wanted to connect with people and be open about all my experiences. And it caused me to not be able to connect with people on a deep level. So for me, re-coming out again was really important for me. And I started, you know, I came out in the workplace. I joined the diversity and inclusion panel. I came out in like the first meeting that I was in there. And to the point that like everyone around me knew that I was trans in the workplace, and I just felt so much more comfortable because there was a little part of me that didn't fully accept myself. And because of that, hiding my trans identity, it felt like others didn't accept me as well. Hmm. Which was, yeah, really. So I really went full out with it. I started getting back online. I started posting about my experiences again. When someone asked me, you know, for a tampon, I would say, yeah, I don't really have much use for that without a womb. I'd make a joke of it. and it was so much lighter for me. It felt so much more comfortable. Just really interesting. You'd think living as a stealth trans woman would be more comfortable. And I will say, in a lot of ways, it was. However, that connection piece was so important to me, and it was the big thing that was cut off. And I don't know if that would be the same for others. There are a bunch of trans people that just want to live their freaking lives. They're like, I want to live on a self-sustaining farm. I want none of no one's bullshit. And I'm just going to be myself and all of that. And I really respect that as well. And I think that that's important that people, they should be able to have that as an option for themselves. And on one hand, I'm grateful that I kind of have that option for myself. But living both of those, I would choose being openly trans, 1000%.
Is there anything in your life that you feel like you've been able to accomplish because of the fact that you're trans?
Oh my goodness, my whole business. As you can see, it's very trans. Colors and everything. A lot of the mindset work that I do nowadays is because I'm trans. It's because I've experienced all of those things and the bullying and all of the stuff that came along with that. And it's enabled me to be able to relate to other trans people and to share an experience that they may not have been able to connect with someone on prior to that. I remember something in particular. I was a suicide crisis supporter for a couple of years. And there was a trans person on the end of that line who was talking about her experiences and the struggles that she was having at that time. And it was something I really related to. I was like, oh my goodness, this girl is me. And yeah, there was a point there where she went, you know what? You probably don't understand what I'm saying anyway, and just hung up. And she was in a very vulnerable state. She was in a very, she was calling a suicide crisis support line. And that just absolutely freaking broke my heart to have that experience. And it reminded me of what power there is in our stories and what power there is in being able to openly and vulnerably share your experience with other people, because other people can connect to it and not feel so alone and feel like someone gets them, someone gets what they're going through. And if I was born cis, I would not be able to connect with trans people in the way that I do. I wouldn't be able to help people the way that I do. I wouldn't be able to understand their perspectives the way that I do. And for me, that is a very unique gift. And it's one that when I was stealth, I wasn't able to use it. And now that I'm out as myself, vulnerably and openly, I can use that to its fullest potential, essentially. And that is what I do now. Like literally everything I do in the mindset work, in the voice work, it's all helping that younger version of me not feel so alone. It's almost like inner child, like healing work to be able to help other people through it.
What is your favorite thing that you have learned through this experience, either about yourself or the world around you?
Oh, I've learned a lot about bigotry and hatred and where that comes from and people's perspectives, how they develop those perspectives, because I've had to dissociate a lot of it from myself. I've had to learn how to brush off certain types of comments and certain types of perspectives and everything. And throughout that process, and this is probably partly autism as well, actually, is like, how do people relate? How do they talk? How do they think? And that's something that I was able to dive really deep into, I think, because of that journey. Is I got this big drive to understand how people develop perspectives, how people develop opinions, beliefs, and attitudes, and where that all comes from. And that's helped me be a much more compassionate and kind person to people. And it's helped me to brush off hate comments a lot easier and to feel more self-confident and, secure in myself. So that for me is a really big learning, and it's one that I yell about it from the rooftops all the time. Like, look at other people's perspectives. Look at where could this possibly have come from? What could their upbringing have possibly have been? You know, what propaganda might they have been exposed to? What's important to them in life? And that's almost been like a special interest for me, is diving into how all of that works. And so now I can use that knowledge and that experience to, one, not let things affect me as much, and two, show compassion for people, even if they're throwing shit in my face.
And how has that helped you, do you feel, in communicating with them and sort of swaying hearts and minds? Or does it just help you to deal with what is coming at you?
It has helped on so many levels with that. This is something that I get a lot of, I get a lot of pushback when I share this, this perspective, but I'm very openly passionate about being kind and compassionate to haters, people that are expressing hateful views, because there is so many more layers to it than people usually understand. And this could be a whole freaking hour in and of itself, like how we process information as humans, how we delete, distort, and generalize information, what sort of biases we have. But essentially, I've dived into understanding all of those things and understanding how the unconscious mind works and all of that. Because when someone throws a hate comment at me, I like to say I'm not reacting to it, I'm responding to it. If I feel myself go into an elevated state, if my heart rate increases, if I start to feel defensive or I start feeling the need to justify or make excuses, I will step back and go, okay, I'm feeling activated at the moment. I'm feeling triggered at the moment. So I'm going to step back, do a little bit of meditation, draw my mind to something else, because sometimes comments do affect me. That is very rarely. That's like if I'm in like a rundown state, if I'm really tired, if I'm like, you know, just like sick of people's bullshit today, that might be one of those times where I have to step back. However, nowadays, because I've practiced this so much, my response to the comment is to show kindness and compassion to them as much as I can. Anything that I could freaking latch onto, I will. So if I make a post about, you know, the age that I transitioned, or if I make a post supporting gender affirming care for people under 18, you know, things like that, there will often be a lot of backlash towards those things. And for me, I like to think about, what values does this person have? What does this person care about? What does this person, what have they been exposed to? What's been their life story? And most of the time, what you'll find is you don't know any of those freaking things. And so for me, I feel like I don't actually have enough information to judge this person. I don't know where they're coming from. I don't know their perspective. And sometimes it's a really simple thing. Well, they'll say, I don't think kids should have access to this, and mutilating the bodies and yada, yada, yada. And I'll just respond saying, hey, thanks for your comment. I can see, you know, from your profile picture that you've got a little kid. You must really care about them. Sometimes that is literally where I'll leave that. I'll just leave it there. And what I find in those interactions is they'll come back again and be like, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, but you, trans people don't exist. Or, blah, 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 with all of the freaking things that they can throw. And I'll just respond compassionately each time. And it takes the wind out of their sails. They go, wait, what? Why is this person not clapping back? And there was one in particular, actually, that was commenting a lot of hateful things on my post. And I said to them, hey, you know, I'm sure there's some other things that you care about in your life, and I really want you to think about the impact that you're having on the people around you, on the world around you, and the impact that you're having with these types of comments is quite a negative one. It's making people feel this way, this way, and this way, and I know that you're probably a good person. You don't want people to feel that way. And so I'd encourage you to redirect that energy into something you're passionate about, something that lights you up, something that helps you do something nice in the world or nice for yourself. And this person commented back like, whoa, okay, I didn't expect that. And they actually said, you know what, you're right. This isn't the kind of person that I want to be. I actually want to be a kinder person and a more thoughtful person. And they left the comment section. I don't know what they're doing with their life now, but to me, that is, for me, it's such an effective way of handling those types of things. Because the worst case scenario is they don't listen and they go off in their tirade and then I block them. That's like worst case scenario. Best case scenario, they go, holy shit, what am I doing with my life? Maybe I do want to have a better impact in the world. And then they go and do that. Win-win, in my view.
I know.
I'll say another little bit on that,
mm-hmm.
because it's such a big topic. But when someone is reacting really negatively and they're throwing hate comments and all of that, they're in a dysregulated state. Like their stress response is on board. When that happens, it literally shuts off people's prefrontal cortex. They do not have the logic and reasoning available to them that they normally would. And so a lot of people, when they're in those interactions, is they'll bring up the facts. And I used to do this all the freaking time. Or like, you don't know what you're talking about. Look at this article. This says this, and look at all the citations on this and blah, blah, blah. And what I didn't realize at the time is they're not actually in a space to receive that information. All it's doing is bringing up their defenses, and they want to fight against their thing because the unconscious mind always wants to be right. And it has a desire to stabilize our identity and to stabilize our beliefs. So if we have a certain belief and someone fights against that belief, the natural inclination is defense. I have to defend this because partly it's defending their identity. But here's the thing. When you listen to and validate someone's perspective, and you go, hey, yeah, that must be really hard for you to see young trans people, you know, transitioning socially. I can see you have a kid. That must be really scary for you. And you must be, you know, concerned about how that might affect your kid seeing those things. You know, I really feel for you. You sound like a really good parent. Like, whoa. They don't usually get that experience. And when you consistently do that, what happens is they move out of a dysregulated state and they move into more of a parasympathetic, you know, nervous system, which is where they're calm. Their logic and reasoning comes back online. And what will happen half the time, not all the time, half the time, they'll come to you and go, hey, you actually really listened to me and heard me out. I'm curious to know your perspective now. And that is so freaking powerful. When someone gets to that state, they feel heard and listened to. The law of reciprocity kicks in. When you're nice and kind to someone else and they feel validated and everything by you, the law of reciprocity kicks in and they actually feel a social obligation to return the favor. Not all the time, but hey, we can use psychological know-how in order to actually interact with these people to actually create change and actually create changed perspectives. This is something I'm really passionate about, as you can probably tell.
So as we close up here, and I know this is another topic that's going to have 1,000 possible answers, but what are some of the key pieces of advice that you have to pass on to younger closeted trans folks out there?
I mean, it's along the same lines as what we were talking about just then. It's understand that other people's opinions of you, other people's perspectives are theirs. That belongs to them. And whether they try to project that onto you or not does not make it yours. And so learning to love and accept yourself as you are and really internalizing that will help shield against any of that stuff that is not helpful for you. And it's easier said than done. There's a lot of, you know, difficult experiences that you'll probably have to go through as a young trans person or a closeted trans person. And just know that you can get to the other side of that and you can use your experiences as a way to inspire other people rather than to push you down.
Jasmine Vine, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your wonderful perspective and this great bit of advice. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Transgender Show from the Transverse Network. Watch this show live Tuesday nights at twitch.tv/thetransverse and later on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/thetransverse. Be sure to check out Jasmine's Trans Boss podcast for more trans empowerment. If you love what we're doing and want to help support the Transverse and get access to exclusive content, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/thetransverse.